Welcome back to Against the Grain. My name is Dr. Samir Kakodkar. I'm a gastroenterologist and specialist in ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Today we are talking about hyperbaric oxygen therapy for inflammatory bowel disease. This is a hot topic with some studies suggesting efficacy in both Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Recently, there's been interest in using it for hospitalized patients with severe ulcerative colitis. We speak with Dr. Scott Scheer, who is a physician with training in internal medicine, and he also practices health optimization medicine. He has a subspecialization in utilizing hyperbaric oxygen for various conditions, and today shares his insights and experience using it off-label for inflammatory bowel disease. As a disclaimer, this is not an endorsement of this therapy for inflammatory bowel disease, since it is still being studied and efficacy has not been established. It is not FDA approved to treat IBD at this time. The purpose of this podcast is to have open discussions with individuals with new and unconventional ideas without offering medical advice. You must discuss all treatment decisions with your physicians. Dr. Scheer, thanks for coming on. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me, Samir. I'm happy to be here. Happy to chat.
So can you give us just a brief kind of some details about your background and how you got interested in hyperbaric oxygen therapy?
Sure. So you want the short story?
Sure.
the short story is that I experienced the benefits, or I saw the benefits of hyperbaric therapy when I was in medical school. When I was working at a trauma center in Baltimore at the University of Maryland, there was people coming in with necrotizing fasciitis or flesh-eating bacteria, carbon monoxide poisoning, you know, basically intubated on respirators going into the chamber, this gigantic submarine-looking thing in the basement, and coming out, especially if it was carbon monoxide poisoning, coming out, walking out off the respirator. So significant improvements with those particular conditions. And I grew up the son of a chiropractor, somebody very outside the box in how he approached health in a very holistic way, looking at various modalities, looking at the spine is one part of it, but also looking at diet and environmental exposures, et cetera. And so I kind of went to medical school thinking that I would find a way to bring that alternative perspective to the conventional world, but I didn't know how. And I went through various ideas of what that would look like. Would I become a gastroenterologist and do colonoscopies and endoscopies? I thought about that for a couple minutes, Samir, actually. I liked the gut. I thought it was an interesting area that really during my medical school, there was no such thing as the gut microbiome. No, but those are words that I never heard. Now, those are very new, as you know. But I went through various specialties, and then hyperbaric oxygen therapy, this particular therapy that I experienced when I was at the trauma center, when I realized it was just a combination of increased atmospheric pressure and increased oxygen in the inspired air that you were breathing. And it was just a combination of these two things that was really having this massive shift in physiology, allowing these people, in those particular cases, carbon monoxide poisoning and neck fash, to have such significant benefits. I was just kind of blown away at the simplicity of it. And so I dove down into the literature, and no pun intended, well, kind of intended a little bit. but I dove into the literature. I'm like, well, what can this be used for? And then I found that there was 14 FDA-approved indications, so those that are approved by Medicare and commercial insurances. And they're... about 50 others, 50, that have really good data, depending on what you believe is really good data. So they have data to support their use. And in some countries like Japan, China, Russia, instead of 14 indications, there are 70. And wow. So as I discovered this and I started talking to people in the field, starting to go to conferences, and I made a move to California in 2013 with my wife and our one daughter at the time, I became a medical director of a facility in San Francisco that was doing a combination of both the on-label, the insurance approved, as well as the off-label hyperbaric work. And then I kind of dove into the world of integrative medicine at the same time, a la my background, which was looking at things in a very holistic way, given the way I grew up, and then having the framework now of hyperbaric oxygen therapy as being my major true north, my center point as to what I really wanted to do, but knowing that it was an integrative strategy that likely would be best for patients. So that's kind of the half short, half long story, I would call it.
Okay, that's cool that you kind of found this niche, even within the you know, the allopathic kind of medicinal sphere, but also within integrative medicine and kind of bringing it all together with this focus on hyperbaric oxygen therapy.
Yeah, yeah. What's nice about it, Samir, is that it was I had the ability, and I still have the ability because of this particular technology, to talk to conventional doctors about it and talk about conventional indications that are actually vastly underutilized in conventional medicine, and then also on the integrative, functional, whatever you want to call the wellness, alternative medicine side of things, I could also speak to them about how hyperbaric therapy could be integrated into their plans for patients and be what I often think about as the sort of the crux of hyperbaric therapy, which is being the ultimate accelerator, synergizer of wound healing from the inside out. So anyway, it's a nice balance for me to be right in the center there.
And you mentioned that there's this list, right, of FDA approved conditions that use hyperbaric oxygen for. Mm-hmm. Can you just name a few of them besides what you mentioned? I know neck fash and carbon monoxide poisoning, but what else is this used for where it's actually FDA approved?
Sure. The other traumatic setting is a couple. There's an acute traumatic ischemias, so limb or partial limb amputations, or severe trauma with compartment syndromes. It's also used for thermal burns, so from fires. For those that are more stable on the outpatient side, which is what I see, I don't see the inpatient stuff. I see patients with diabetic foot ulcers that are non-healing, refractory to conventional care. They respond very well to hyperbaric therapy under the right conditions and the appropriate criteria. So saving amputations, improving quality of life. Also in patients that have had radiation from cancer, so radiation to the prostate, to the breast, to the GI system, head and neck, and they get left with radiation injuries. And these are injuries that aren't the acute radiation injuries, which normally get better, but these are more of the chronic injuries that happen 6 months or later, or they don't go away for 6 months after the initial exposure. And hyperbaric therapy is extremely effective for radiation injury. The studies, there have been a number of them, but the best one showed basically an 80% improvement overall in patients with symptoms of radiation injury. And so those are the two major ones that we see. The other ones that we don't see as much, but as effective are osteomyelitis, so chronic bone infections, refractory to usual care, or if they're in particular areas that are very difficult to treat, like a mediastinal osteomyelitis after a cardiac surgery, for example, you know, and the chest or the chest plate or the ribs themselves or the sternum. Also, sudden hearing loss, so sudden sensory neural hearing loss specifically. And so hyperbaric therapy is approved by commercial insurance plans for the treatment of that particular indication.
Okay. And as far as I know your center does address some conditions that are off-label. And some of the ones that I've just kind of heard...
We all treat conditions that are off-label. We all do it, but I do it in hyperbaric medicine too, to be clear, Samir.
Yeah. True. Yeah, that's true in gastroenterology as well.
Yes, I'm sure there's a number of examples.
Do a lot of things that we don't have perfect data for. But there are certain conditions I've just heard kind of like through the media and through news stories that some people are using for, like I've heard of athletes using it just kind of overall just to help the performance. I think LeBron James, there may have been a story about that. And obviously Michael Jackson, there were stories about him sleeping in one for some time.
Yeah, for good reason though. I'll tell you, he had thermal burns from the Pepsi commercial back in the 80s.
Right. Okay.
Now, if he used it for other reasons, I don't know, but that's the initial reason why he got the chamber, just to make the record clear.
Okay.
But you're right. There's lots of indications where hyperbaric therapy has been used in the popular press and also for various complex medical illness. What I like to think about here, Samir, is what's happening in a hyperbaric chamber. What is the physiology, and then taking and extrapolating from there, you can look at various data sets, various conditions, and how hyperbaric therapy interacted with those particular inflammatory mediators or cytokines for that you know, for that particular indication. So the way I like to think about it is this, if you don't mind bearing with me for a second, is that hyperbaric oxygen therapy works by driving more oxygen into the body by combining an increased atmospheric pressure, so the pressure around the chamber or inside the chamber, and then increased inspired oxygen that you're breathing. It's the combination of the two that drives more oxygen into the body, not saturating the red blood cells, which are usually saturated just fine at sea level air, but actually saturating the plasma of the blood itself. So increasing oxygen carrying capacity in the plasma itself. And then once that oxygen's inside the body, it causes oxidative stress, or actually causes the production of reactive oxygen species that have an effect on end products of the, or various aspects of the physiology. So the first thing that happens, you acutely go into the chamber, you have an acute vasoconstriction that happens. So the blood vessels actually constrict. And the net is you're still getting more oxygen to the body, to the system, because you have so much saturated in the plasma. But that's really good. If you have an acute trauma, an acute surgery, or even an elective surgery, you're going to have swelling after that, right? So hyperbaric therapy is going to constrict those vessels, decrease swelling. Mm-hmm. So an example of that in condition-based management is a surgery, but also somebody that had a severe traumatic brain injury. And there was a study done in traumatic brain injured adults. If they got into the chamber the first 3 days post severe traumatic brain injury, their mortality rate was half, 50% less. And the result of that really seemed to be because of decreasing intracranial pressure. Okay. So again, you get into the chamber, you have an acute stimulus of oxygen, you have a direct vasoconstriction of blood vessels, decreasing swelling. Okay. So there's a number of other oxidative stress-related acute indications. But on the chronic side, what hyperbaric therapy is doing is causing an epigenetic change on the DNA itself, causing a suppression and expression of various genes that are oxygen sensitive, that allow the whole body to sort of improve the whole healing process, regrowing new blood vessels, stem cell release, various other aspects of physiology. And I know I'm kind of talking a lot here. So what I would just kind of suffice to say is that what it all comes down to is hyperbaric does this. It decreases inflammation by modulating certain cytokines like TNF-alpha, IL-1, IL-6, and IL-12. It reverses hypoxia or low oxygen states. It does that acutely by flooding the body with oxygen, and more chronically by creating new blood vessels. It causes a massive release of stem cells from the bone marrow and neurogenic, the brain itself, allowing those stem cells to go where they need to go. And it is also fighting infection. So killing bacteria, fungus, and virus, especially do not like high oxygen environments. And then thus regenerating tissue from the inside out.
So all of these mechanisms you mentioned, at least most of them, have relevance with, in particular, for inflammatory bowel disease.
Right.
Obviously, down-regulating cytokines. And you talked about this kind of hypoxic environment of this chronic inflammatory state.
Right.
And, you know, perhaps this oxygenation would allow it to break that cycle that occurs. And then you talked about stem cells. You know, stem cells are possibly maybe responsible for some of the mucosal healing we see with this therapy that's been seen in certain case series. But, you know, they're also studying stem cell therapy for fistulizing Crohn's disease, and there's been some efficacy there. So if this is a therapy that can mobilize stem cells, that has a lot of application, not just in IBD, but a lot of different conditions.
Yeah, so there was a study that was done recently, and I think you know about this one, looking at colonic stem cells in a hyperbaric environment. Mm-hmm. And a significant improvement or increase in the number of colonic stem cells mobilized in the hyperbaric environment. And there's been various studies in the IBD world with hyperbaric oxygen therapy. Most of them, as you know, Samir, have been small. There was a study done relatively recently in Egypt that did significantly high pressure, but took some patients that were refractory to other treatments and put them into remission with, I think it was 20 hyperbaric sessions at that time. So, there's been significant, I think, interest in this field, and you and I both know a researcher at Dartmouth that's working on recruiting for a study looking at ulcerative colitis specifically. But I think a lot of the mechanisms are at play. In fact, there is one study that was done that specifically looked at a model of IBD and TNF-alpha specifically, and how hyperbaric therapy downregulated the production of TNF-alpha specifically. And there was another one that sort of equated hyperbaric therapy to being as powerful as steroids as its sort of anti-inflammatory capabilities. And there's a couple other conditions that's also been shown to be the case. So it's a pretty profound anti-inflammatory, that's for sure.
And so are you treating inflammatory bowel disease patients? Do you have some of these people coming to you, to your center?
We do, yeah. And you know, interestingly enough, you know, I have colleagues across the country that I work with. I have clinics in San Francisco and New York that I work with on the ground, as well as Oregon. But I talk to a lot of people around the country as well. And we talk about the challenge with the community of hyperbaric facilities that are not that are doing off-label work is that we're mostly doing it in silos. So that's been a big challenge. But it is changing a little bit. I think that we're looking at various ways at stopping or transitioning to more of a collaborative spirit. And one of the ways to do that is by having things run by the same company, potentially, or at least affiliated. But anyway, long story short, is that what we started off seeing is that patients that came in for on-label conditions like diabetic foot ulcers, radiation injury from cancer, their ulcerative colitis and Crohn's was getting better. So by accident, right? Because we have them coming into the chamber because of diabetic foot ulcers and radiation, but all of a sudden their Crohn's symptoms are significantly improved, or their inflammatory bowel disease symptoms of, you know, whatever derivation are better. And so over the last couple of years, we've been treating more and more patients with inflammatory bowel disease. And I can't tell you that that everybody is getting better. But I can say that those that have had, in my experience, is those that have had any surgeries related to Crohn's or ulcerative colitis have healed better. And fistulas, for example, in Crohn's have improved at a much higher clip versus the experience that I've seen outside of that. And I've also had patients that would have refractory Crohn's and ulcerative colitis that have come down significantly on their medications, sometimes on their disease-modifying medications as well. Improving quality of life almost across the board, I think. And I think that also has to do with just the general physiologic shifts that you're seeing, not only in the gut, but also sort of systemically as well when somebody's getting a full protocol of hyperbaric therapy.
So just to clarify that point, you said it's more the post-surgical, and I know this is just anecdotal experience. This is not, doesn't constitute evidence or anything, but this is right. Just your experience. But you said for patients who've had Crohn's, patients who've had surgery or who've had fistulas. So are you talking about like people who've had like small bowel resections, like an ileal resection, and they have like disease recurrence afterwards, or interior right. cutaneous fistulas, yeah. that type of thing?
Yeah, the thing at this point, Samir, is that most people come to hyperbaric medicine after they've tried everything else.
Right.
So we tend to get the hardest cases, mm-hmm. the most refractory cases. Occasionally, we're seeing people at earlier stages, but for the most part, we're seeing people sort of at the later or the more difficult to treat stages. And in those patients, we are seeing significant improvements. Like they are coming down on their medications. They do have better quality of life. But we're not seeing, you know, as remissions all the time. I think one of the reasons is that we're just starting to understand sort of the colonic physiology. And it seems to me that actually deeper treatments are going to be necessary for a significant proportion of these patients. And the challenge of the deeper treatments is that it's a little bit more prone to potential having side effects of hyperbaric therapy. So you have to be a little more careful. And so if people are on medications that that could potentially interact, we have to be careful there too. So we're just kind of, I think, on the cusp here of really understanding, you know, where hyperbaric therapy is best utilized in inflammatory bowel disease. I think given my experience in patients that are, surgical or post-surgical or have intracutaneous fistulas. Those are the patients that I've seen do the best because that's what we've seen the most of. But we have seen those with hard to control. And even those, I've actually had a couple of cases just thinking about it, of those that are sort of more milder, but on the spectrum, but I've gotten hyperbaric therapy for other reasons, and their Crohn's and ulcerative colitis has gotten better too. So I think across the board, I can say that people have improved, but I think that it's a spectrum.
Okay. Sure. And then just to play devil's advocate and see, have you seen cases where there's no effect? Just to balance it on the other side, because when we talk about medical therapy and inflammatory bowel disease, there's plenty of people who get no effect. Like you can put them on Remicade, you can put them on Entyvio, and it just doesn't have any effect whatsoever. So
yeah,
in your experience, have you seen people who just have no effect at all, which is expected with any treatment in IBD?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, on my end personally, I've had one patient that did not get better. She had ulcerative colitis and just did not improve with, I think she got 40 hyperbaric sessions, which is a good trial of hyperbaric therapy for sure. So, and she didn't get better. I know of at least a couple cases in New York and that also didn't improve. Often these patients, it's multifactorial, right? Again, just like what you described before, why does somebody not get better because of Remicade and others? We just don't know why, so I don't have a good answer as to why these patients didn't get better. But overall, the improvements in quality of life, symptom control, and coming down on medications has been seen across the board. And full remissions for refractory cases, I haven't seen that many patients. That is relatively new data, as you know. And so I've been very interested in having more patients come through. But as you know, Samir, and maybe your audience I'm sure they're quite smart and knows this too. If it's an off-label treatment, hyperbaric therapy is then, as a result, not going to be covered by insurance. And so each treatment is an out-of-pocket expense. And depending on where you're in the country, that treatment cost could be anywhere from $200 a session to $450 a session. Mm-hmm. And for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's, for the chronic manifestations of it, we're talking at least 20 treatments, but probably more like 40, really to give it a good trial to see if it's going to help. And those treatments are done Monday through Friday with the weekends off for that protocol. So it's a significant time investment as well as a monetary investment. Understanding that we do know that the benefits can be great, the risks are minimal if hyperbaric therapy is done safely, which is something that we can chat about. But we don't know what the outcome is going to be, so we don't know if it's going to help or not. And that's significant for patients. And I really do understand that.
And you mentioned that it's like 20 to 40 sessions. Is this what you foresee that to be? Like, what happens after that? Let's say somebody responds. Is there kind of like a maintenance regimen? Because that sounds kind of like a corollary to how we use medical therapy in IBD, where there's like an induction regimen for people who you're inducing remission. And then there's almost always some sort of maintenance strategy after that. Is that what you would foresee using this treatment? Would it be in the same style as that?
Yeah, it's fantastic you mentioned that, Samir, because we don't have the data to support it yet. Okay.
Right. But
what I have found in patients that have chronic inflammatory conditions, whether it's ulcerative colitis, Crohn's, or if it's a rheumatoid arthritis, another like an autoimmune kind of presentation, where you have this chronic inflammatory state, if hyperbaric therapy is effective, what will likely happen over time is that inflammation will return. However, if you do a maintenance regimen of hyperbaric therapy, I have found that can be very successful in keeping that inflammation at bay. Now, what does that hyperbaric protocol look like? It depends on the person. And this is all very anecdotal here, as you can tell. What I try to think about, Samir, is why do you have inflammatory bowel disease? Why do you have autoimmune disease? And this takes you out of the conventional world, really, and takes you more into the the functional medicine integrative world of and the experimental world of why do these things occur in the first place. And if you try to address underlying causes, underlying reasons why this may happen, then that's your best bet. Now, inflammatory bowel disease, we don't know what those are. We don't think. You know, some people have ideas. You know, I've heard crazy stories about any number of things in inflammatory bowel disease, just like everything else. But the data doesn't support it yet. So, but ideally, you address the underlying reason, and then hyperbaric therapy at the same time, and then you're good over the long term. But if you don't have an underlying reason, then you have to manage symptoms and manage inflammatory cascades. And I think hyperbaric therapy can be a part of a maintenance regimen in that case.
Yeah. So from what you said, it sounds like maybe hyperbaric oxygen can be kind of a bridge. It's like a bridge.
Well, it can be maintenance, right? It can help you maintain a certain effect if it does give you that effect, you know?
But you probably have to do some other aspects. And I know you do practice some aspects of functional medicine as well.
I do.
So, you know, potentially addressing certain things about lifestyle may also kind of help things out in the long term.
Yeah, I have another program, Samir, called Health Optimization Medicine, and it's HOME for short. And it was founded by a colleague and a mentor. His name is Dr. Ted Atricoso, and I think you know, you've heard about Dr. Ted already, and you know our mutual friend, Dr. Shaker Pai. And so, you know, this whole program is part of that, Samir. The idea really is that we need to have a foundational health of our cellular energy metabolism, of our gut health, of our immune sensitivities, and potentially hormonal health, depending on age, that we all need. And that's the foundation. And so health optimization medicine was founded to be that foundation. And then, of course, then the functional medicine stuff goes on top of that, whether you have, you know, if we have to fight, if there's infection, if there's other sort of dysregulations that need more specialized care. But health optimization medicine was set up so that you kind of work on your cellular health, you know, vitamins, minerals, cofactors, antioxidants, toxins, and looking at gut health, looking at, you know, various gut bacteria is part of it, but we could probably have a whole podcast on how nobody really knows what any of that means right now. What we do know in the gut is things that you already know much better than me, Samir, like, you know, inflammatory testing, like, you know, pancreatic elastase and secretory IgA specific carbohydrates and all these other aspects of what can help with the gut working better, and then looking at immune sensitivities and foods to avoid. So that's what I try to do first with all my patients. And then after that, hyperbaric therapy on top of it, if possible, because then you know you have the machinery to, I think, sustain the benefits of hyperbaric therapy over a longer period of time.
Okay. And then I just wanted to make one comment about, you mentioned hyperbaric oxygen, one of the potential mechanisms is antimicrobial. And there are a certain group of people, a group of gastroenterologists who believe Crohn's disease is caused by an infectious agent. Multiple have been theorized to cause it, but one that has been gaining support is Mycobacterium avium paratuberculosis.
Yeah. I was thinking about that one before when I was talking about crazy ideas.
And they have fulfilled Koch's postulates as far as proving causation of it. They have. It may have been in somewhat of a roundabout way, but they did do it, and it has been proven to cause Yoni's disease in cows, which appears similar, not identical, but similar to Crohn's disease in humans.
Interesting.
So you wonder, you know, maybe it's addressing that. And my personal belief is I think maybe that bacteria is the cause of Crohn's in some people. It's possible. But, you know, the data on the using the antibiotics to treat that, to target that, the long-term efficacy is questionable. Although there was some short-term benefit, but long-term, it hasn't been proven out that that's an effective strategy in using a cocktail of antibiotics against this MAP bacteria.
Interesting. Yeah, that's more than I knew. But I think I agree with you. I mean, there's sort of this end process, which is inflammatory bowel disease, that likely has an etiology, just like autistic spectrum disorder or lots of other autoimmune conditions, not to say autism is, but just autoimmune conditions on their own, like MS, for example, is another one where we think there might be a viral subset of people that have a viral infection that then leads to MS, right? Or is it Lyme disease for some people, for example, right? Is it autoimmune regulation as related to Lyme? So I think you find this in a lot of these unfortunate conditions that are chronic inflammatory, that there is an end process, but how you got there is probably multifactorial. Mm-hmm. Toxins in the environment are a big one these days, I think, too, Samir. So I think a lot of what we're seeing is a sort of a toxic epigenetic expression in some ways. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so emphatic about, you know, checking people and looking at toxic exposure.
So in particular, could you mention a few major toxins that you suspect may be contributing to certain diseases, particularly if possible for IBD? What are some of the major offenders that you're suspicious of?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think of a couple. One of the ones that, I mean, I think of heavy metals primarily, especially from, and then I think of industrial pollutants. Those are the ones that I think of as being the biggest ones that I see. Some preservatives in food, like the benzoic acids of the world as well. And I also see, and I don't know if we're going to call them toxins exactly, Samir, but antibiotics as well. How it changes our gut microbiome and especially on the overuse side of things. So I would say those are the ones that I worry about the most. You know, I think about the most when I'm talking to patients. And okay. As far as directly to IBD, I can't say. I mean, you probably have more if there's any specific correlates.
Well, there is some data. I mean, diet has always been, you know, one of the main things people look at as far as environmental influences contributing to IBD. At least that's been historically studied. One of the things that I'm suspicious of is emulsifiers or different preservatives and emulsifiers that are put into the food supply that can influence the microbiome, influence the gut barrier integrity, and perhaps lead to a predisposition to IBD.
What would be an example of an emulsifier for you?
Like there's different like polysorbates.
The polysorbates, that's what I was thinking. They use those in vaccinations to break down the blood-brain barrier too. So it would make sense to me.
Okay. Yeah. You know, perhaps that can have an effect on the integrity of the gut.
Gut integrity is a big one, right? So I think that's kind of where you're looking at with a lot of these toxin exposures is that, and I think about that a lot as far as food intake and dietary intake. And it sounds like that's kind of where you're going here, right? It's like the gut barrier gets disrupted and then you have immune reactions and they get out of control and, you know, several years later, you have inflammatory bowel disease.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I think it could be, you know, obviously we don't have proof of this yet, but it could be a contributor. A few other ones is carrageenan, which is, you know, seaweed derived, and it's been shown to induce colitis in mouse models. And there was even a small randomized controlled trial that was done looking at the addition of carrageenan into people's diets with IBD. And there was a signal that having more carrageenan in the diet led to more flares. And you tend to see carrageenan, at least I'm someone who always reads food labels, and I see carrageenan mostly in like store-bought popsicles. If you go to the store and you see popsicles in the freezer, like fruit bars or like strawberry popsicles or like a mango bar or something like that, it usually has carrageenan, which gives that kind of smooth consistency to the food.
Okay, that's good for me to know too. I knew about carrageenan specifically in the polysorbate, but yeah, it's really interesting to mention that. I mean, I think that what I typically do, Samir, in my practice is that I am an integrator, right? So I like to integrate different technologies and therapeutics together in a way that makes the most sense for patients. But I think what it always starts with, always, is the diet, right? And I'm looking at a couple of things, looking at an evolutionary biology perspective on diet, given backgrounds and epigenetics and sort of the genetic predispositions, as well as, you know, looking at the data in things like, in conditions like inflammatory bowel disease, and what's, you know, has been shown to be most helpful. And there's various, you know, more about than me, but I often find, and as this is something that I think your listeners can imagine, that if you're doing some things together, you typically have better results than doing one thing only. So,
And
the nice thing about hyperbaric therapy is it's really not mutually exclusive to anything else, except for a couple chemotherapeutics, for example, that you don't want to do directly with it. And those are some older the chemotherapy drugs like bleomycin and adriamycin, for example. Mm-hmm. So there's no real worry for you to have any sort of interactions in that capacity. So that's why, of course, I mean, depending on the type of if you're going and getting infusions, we may want to watch and kind of, you know, tread carefully while you're doing them together, just because if it's not been studied. But overall, I haven't had any bad experiences in that respect at all.
Okay. One topic I wanted to bring up was, and I'm not sure if you'll have an answer for this, but one of the mysteries in the field of inflammatory bowel disease is, why does smoking make ulcerative colitis better and make Crohn's disease worse? We don't have an explanation for that, but it's a very real observation that we see clinically. Mm-hmm. I've seen several patients who even have failed many medications, who have had ulcerative colitis, who are particularly former smokers. And then, you know, you'll tell them to smoke 3 to 5 cigarettes a day. And sometimes we actually do recommend that, and they get better, and usually quickly. And that can even be used as a maintenance regimen.
Have you tried other types of nicotine delivery mechanisms other than smoking, or just as it has to be smoking?
It's kind of mixed. Different gastroenterologists do different things. Actually, it's very rare for people to actually recommend this because, you know, the negative effects of smoking are very clear to everyone.
Right.
But the rationale for this is like low-dose smoking, 3 to 5 cigarettes a day. Overall, if it's going to help your colitis to the degree where you're not requiring these really big gun immunosuppressive medications, overall in the grand scheme of things, it may be okay to do.
Yeah.
But we tend to just use cigarettes. Now, there's some people who try patches, but overall, I think the efficacy is not as good as actually smoking.
Interesting. The question, I guess, is what is in the smoking that's actually helping? I mean, if it's the nicotine, I mean, there are lots of different nicotine delivery systems, as we all know. I mean, there's gum, there's spray, there's intranasal, I mean, whatever. I mean, but I think what's, I mean, who knows exactly, but I think what's likely happening with the nicotine is it's causing a vasoconstriction, right? And mm-hmm. So maybe that's causing a decreased inflammation in the colon. I mean, therapy works in a similar way. As I mentioned to you earlier, hyperbaric therapy causes a vasoconstriction, decreases the size of blood vessels, and as a result of that, less fluid leaks out of them because they're not as big, and fluid gets shunted away. So it may be a reason why hyperbaric therapy most of the studies I've seen have been in ulcerative colitis, actually, for hyperbaric therapy and not in Crohn's, although in Crohn's it's mostly been like the more complicated ones with fistulizing disease, et cetera. So it could be why there's a corollary there, but it's probably too early in our literature to say exactly. But I mean, I have no problem with nicotine itself. I think that a lot of the data scares people, but I mean, there's some data actually that shows that it's not the nicotine in cigarettes that's addictive, but it's actually the combination of nicotine with all the other chemicals in the cigarettes that's causing the addictive qualities. Nicotine itself is a cognitive enhancer. It works as a nootropic to help with brain function. So in the performance world, which also hyperbaric therapy is a part of, I have and I know people using nicotine for cognitive enhancement, and I think there is probably a subset of people that get addicted to it. But I don't think it's not as easy to get addicted to nicotine in other delivery mechanisms other than cigarettes, it seems. So interesting point, that's all.
And I just wanted to make one comment on the, you know, before we go on to a couple other topics. And you mentioned the studies for of hyperbaric oxygen for inflammatory bowel disease. And in preparing for this interview, I did do some reading. And the one randomized controlled trial I saw for, and this was in hospitalized patients with ulcerative colitis. This was in 2013, and it compared it to standard of care. But their standard of care was only steroid preparations and mesalamine, which when we treat patients with who are hospitalized for ulcerative colitis, we tend to use probably biologics if they're not responding to steroids. But according to this study, there was no statistical difference in outcomes, but really only 4 patients completed the whole protocol.
Yeah.
So it was underpowered and it wasn't blinded either. Obviously. Yeah, yeah. It was, I guess it was tough to blind.
It's tough to blind for hyperbaric therapy. Yeah.
Cause you sense it right in your ears.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's really, that's one of the challenges of our field, Samir, is that a placebo controlled trial is very difficult in a hyperbaric chamber because you feel that pressurization in your ears. So as soon as you turn the pressure on, you turn the chamber on, you get that pressure sensation. Hypothetically, you could give everybody tubes in their ears and they wouldn't know, but that's probably not going to get across too many, institutional review boards to do. Mm-hmm. So what they do instead often is you'll see a sham study where you have somebody get less pressure, less oxygen versus somebody getting more pressure and more oxygen. The challenge with those is that as soon as you start pressurizing the chamber, you're changing physiology, even if you're just pressurizing it a little bit, and even if you don't give 100% oxygen. Because we, there's 2 things that are happening, right? There's the increased amount of oxygen in circulation, but it's also the pressure. And the pressure itself probably has an effect at least on the lymphatics and blood flow itself, at the very least. And I think there are some studies to show, mild pressure effects having significant hemodynamic changes. And like I think the place that I think about often here, Samir, is the Dead Sea in Israel. The Dead Sea is below sea level, but the atmospheric pressure equivalent is like 1.03, I think, ATA. And in the chambers, we go to one. So for ulcerative colitis or something, we're going to go to at least 2 atmospheres of pressure, which is the equivalent of 33 feet below the sea. But even at the Dead Sea, there are tons of studies that have been done showing the improvements in pulmonary function, cardiac function, and others just with that kind of pressure. So as you can tell, I'm not a huge fan of the sham controlled studies because of that. I mean, the Israelis who are doing a lot of the research in the hyperbaric world are doing randomized crossover control studies. Mm-hmm. So everybody gets treated at different times. And that seems to be, although there's arguments against not doing it this way, it seems to be probably one of the best study designs in the hyperbaric field just because of the difficulties with controlling everything.
Okay. And for people who are interested, maybe people interested in researching this, researching protocols, or even patients who are interested in investigating this and trying it, what is the protocol like for inflammatory bowel disease, as far as what do people usually use, how many atmospheres, how many sessions?
Sure. Yeah, again, I can't give you this as medical advice, right, because I don't know
right.
listening. But as in general, where the studies have shown to be most effective, the ones that have been done, and like you said, Samir, there's only been that one randomized control, but there's more coming, as we know, is usually an atmospheric depth of between 2 and 2.8 atmospheres. So that's the equivalent of 33 feet to about 60 feet of seawater. And the treatment length is usually around 90 minutes. Typically, what's going to happen during the deeper treatments is that you get something called air breaks. So at every 30-minute interval, you get 5 minutes where instead of breathing 100% oxygen, you're breathing 21% oxygen, which is the amount of oxygen in the air at sea level. What that does is decreases the risk of oxygen toxicity. And also, interestingly, Samir, and this is new research that's out of Israel, but the relative hypoxia that happens because you're going from 100% oxygen to 21% oxygen, which is a relative hypoxia, even though you're going down to normal oxygen, stimulates something called HIF, or hypoxic inducible factor. And a hypoxic inducible factor is allowing more blood vessel growth and stem cell release to happen. So interestingly enough, you wouldn't think that you'd have HIF released in a chamber, but it is because you have that relative hypoxia of going from 100% to 21%. So anyway, back to the protocol, you have between 20 and 40 sessions is where most of these the treatment regimens are going. And they're done at those depths that I mentioned. And the treatments are done in successive days, so Monday through Friday with the weekends off, typically. And that's because hyperbaric therapy is working directly on your DNA itself, causing epigenetic changes to the DNA, what's expressed and suppressed. And that takes that cumulative process to happen. And then once that cumulative process and epigenetic change happens, then you start seeing the manifestations of that, which is in the remissions or the improves in quality of life or healing some of the fistulas, et cetera.
Okay.
So before that, like 4 or 5 sessions, I don't usually recommend for most people unless they have an acute reason. So if they just had surgery, if they just had some sort of intervention that caused an inflammatory response, then that's when you can use a short period of hyperbaric therapy to help stimulate the healing process.
Okay. And you talk about these epigenetic changes from this treatment. And that whenever I think of a new treatment or a potential intervention for inflammatory bowel disease, I always bring it back to like evolution and how a lot of these, particularly autoimmune diseases, occur in areas of westernization where there's more of an indoor modern lifestyle. And is there any way you can put that into the context of that? Is this addressing something that we're not doing in our modern lifestyles, this therapy that's turning on these genes that should otherwise be on without needing this therapy?
Yeah, it's a really good question, Samir, and I love the focus on the evolutionary aspect of, you know, what are we missing? You know, why is this needed? Is there some sort of equivalent? And the answer, I believe, is that it's really a combination of our environment being so different than it was back, you know, thousands of years ago. One of the examples I can mention is a little bit controversial, I think, but the idea of easy water. Have you heard of Gerald Pollack's work in the University of Washington looking at the fourth phase of water?
Right, yes. Yes, yeah. I'm familiar with that, but I'm pretty sure most people listening have not heard of that. So
yeah, I mean, the idea here is that you know, if the heart were to be pumping blood through all of our miles and miles of capillaries and getting and doing all of it just with the heart itself, it would have to be pumping like 10,000 times stronger. So there has to be more local factors around blood vessels or inside of them or in the cells within the blood vessel walls that are actually allowing this pumping to happen. And what Gerald Pollack's work has been showing is that around lipophilic membranes or ones that like fat, for example, there becomes an area around it called easy water, which is water that's polarized. Basically, it's structured around it. And we think that we know that light potentially can make more structured water. And so more pumping of the blood, okay, in this case. And we think hyperbaric therapy can do something similar, okay, make more easy water around blood vessels, helping with blood vascular flow. So I think one of the things that hyperbaric therapy is sort of modulating is this sort of caveman-esque idea of having better vascular flow, having better detoxification mechanisms, because hyperbaric therapy is going to help with that. It's going to having better sort of immune system regulation, which hyperbaric therapy can help with as well. But it really is sort of like a new age hack to try to combat some of the detrimental aspects of modern lifestyle. I mean, so for example, I talk about this with patients, Samir. The challenges with hyperbaric therapy, one of them is ear pressure, right? And so it's difficult to go down in pressure or go underneath the water equivalent as we're doing in a chamber. Your ears don't like it. You have to depressurize them. Not difficult for most people, but it's harder for people to dive down to depth than it is for them to come back up once they're at the depth of treatment. And I think the reason for this evolutionarily is that whoever created us or whatever we evolved from wanted us not to dive down deep in the water because we could drown. If we were down underneath the water and needed to get up, they wanted us to get the hell up as fast as possible so we didn't die. So it's easier for us to come up out of the water versus down into the water. So that's my long-winded answer for you.
That makes sense. That's interesting observation. Okay, so I think we have just a few minutes left. And I'm sure many people are wondering, this therapy, a lot of the medicines we use in inflammatory bowel disease are overall safe. There are adverse events that are associated with them, but they're all very rare, which is why we use the medications. So particularly in the inflammatory bowel disease community, we're always wondering, is there a downside? Are there adverse effects associated with this? And should we be worried about anything?
Yeah. So really important. I often say that hyperbaric therapy is safer than taking a Tylenol.
Okay.
Because there's very defined risk factors with hyperbaric therapy that can be easily screened out. Okay. So they go as follows here. So the biggest risk is to your ears, like we talked about. If you can't decompress with the pressure, you could potentially rupture your tympanic membrane. That's very easy to prevent. You just have to remember that if you have pressure in your ear, you can't release. We can stop the hyperbaric chamber's pressurization at any time, and you should have no problem. Sometimes you get some mild trauma, but not too severe. That's the first. Second is that if you have any congestion in the eyes or allergies, it can be difficult to clear your ears. So it's important you get some Flonase and some other nasal rinses to help. Most of us have been on a plane with a sinus infection, and it's no fun. Same deal in a chamber. Mm-hmm. At the deeper pressures, hyperbaric therapy is going to temporarily change the convexity of the lens in the eye. So it's going to be more difficult to see far and easier to see close. But that goes back to normal within 1 month to 6 months post finishing treatment. Some of the other side effects, it does improve insulin sensitivity. So your blood sugar is going to drop. If you're a diabetic, that's important to know. If you're ketogenic, then it's no problem. Your ketones are going to rise. Your glucose will go low. No problem. Also, a couple of other things to mention. You are in a high oxygen environment, in a high pressure environment, so there is a flammability concern. Any of the hyperbaric facilities that you go to should not be putting you or allowing you to go into your own clothes. You should be going in scrubs, for example, to try to prevent any static electricity. It's also a confined space, so claustrophobia is something that we have to factor in. For most people, it's not a problem. But for some people, it is. So it's something we have to talk about. The three major conditions that we have to think about, Samir, from an illness medicine perspective, are congestive heart failure. If your ejection fraction is less than 35%, you have an increase in systemic vascular resistance in the chamber that could put you into pulmonary edema. So we don't typically like patients to be having ejection fractions less than 35%. Although we can do it in an emergent setting, we don't do it electively. In patients that have COPD or restrictive lung disease, hyperbaric therapy works through the lungs. And so if you have difficulty diffusing oxygen into your lungs, or if you have bullous lung disease, if you have air pockets in your lungs, those could be all dangerous. So in patients that have COPD, if they've been smokers, if they have bad sleep apnea, if they have pulmonary fibrosis, you just need to have an assessment before getting into the chamber. And the final one is if you have a history of seizure disorder. So oxygen-induced seizures are a possibility. They're very rare, and we can mitigate for them easily. One of the ways we can do that is by using air brakes, like I mentioned before. And actually, I've seen patients with seizures have better control after hyperbaric therapy. But if they're uncontrolled seizures in somebody that is also on medications that decrease seizure threshold, tramadol, Wellbutrin, for example, high-dose narcotics, another, those patients are at higher risk for getting seizures in the chamber. Now, if you get a seizure in the chamber, there's no long-term effects or complications. It's kind of like a febrile seizure in a child, but it's something we don't want to happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's it.
Great. And then there's just, I know mitochondria is kind of a hot topic in you know, functional medicine circles as far as optimizing that. And is there any concern that more oxygen in the system will lead to more? I know this is very complicated as far as reactive oxygen's production of oxygen-free radicals and how there can be leakage of electrons from the electron transport chain. If they combine with oxygen, you can get more free radicals. And then there's this whole theory about aging and chronic disease related to free radicals. But also there's people who say that, you know, there's the free radicals are also signaling molecules and are needed for certain cellular processes. So is there any concern about this causing more free radicals and over time, if this is used chronically and perhaps causing more damage, or is it kind of like unknown?
Yeah. So there was a review that was recently done by a colleagues of mine in Florida, Dominic DiAgostino and Angela Poff. There's a research lab in Florida where they work, and they're doing a lot of work on the ketogenic diet, hyperbaric oxygen therapy, and cancer, for example, mostly, and some other stuff on wound healing, and some other research as well. But they did a really nice job doing a literature review looking at what hyperbaric therapy is doing. And like I mentioned earlier, it is causing oxidative stress, and it's doing that by causing reactive oxygen molecules, reactive oxygen species. But what it's also doing, Samir, is it's causing a reactive antioxidant response from normal cells. And so as a result of that reactive antioxidant response, it combats the oxidative response that's happening with the hyperbaric exposure. So that's things like the NRF2 pathways, glutathione synthase, superoxide dismutase. All of those pathways and products are upregulated with hyperbaric exposure. So in patients that have ongoing inflammation, chronic complex medical illness, I strongly feel that measuring antioxidant levels, levels of oxidative stress, vitamins, minerals, cofactors, not just B12 and folate, but the rest of the B vitamins, looking at, you know, CoQ10 and other antioxidants is extremely important, because you want to have good stores of those before you are going to have an oxidative type of therapy like hyperbaric therapy, because you need to have that ability to have the reactive antioxidant response to the oxidative stress. So I think it's a balance, right? So and that's why I don't recommend, like, for example, in really sick refractory Crohn's patients and ulcerative colitis patients, these patients, I promise you, have a lack of antioxidant capacity. And so it's, in my mind, that's why health optimization medicine is so important, is that you look at all this stuff and you replete and you balance and you also detoxify, and then you're ready for an initial exposure like hyperbaric therapy and more primed to have a more optimal response.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So Dr. Scherer, thank you so much for coming on. I know you have to go. Are you going to go and have more patients to see today, or?
I do. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I know you're very busy. So, but thank you so much for your time. And this was very enlightening discussion. I'm sure a lot of patients and gastroenterologists will find this information valuable and thought-provoking.
I hope so. Samir, I really appreciate the venue to talk about hyperbaric therapy within the realm of IBD and others. And I think the biggest takeaway for me is I get that it's off-label, it's expensive, but I've seen significant benefits. And I think about just the underlying physiology of what's happening in the chamber, right? We're decreasing inflammation, we're reversing hypoxia, we're causing an exponential release in stem cells, we're fighting infection. So think about it in that perspective, along with the perspective of an integrated approach where it doesn't have to be done exclusively. In fact, it should not be done exclusively, but more in a comprehensive understanding of diet, lifestyle factors, health optimization medicine, et cetera. So that's where you're going to have your best outcomes.
Great. Thank you. Again, thanks for your time. And hopefully we can have you back sometime in the future. If this becomes more mainstream and we can get some more details on how to use this optimally.
And if patients or clients or family members are interested, I do have a virtual practice at integrativehbot.com, my website. And so I talk to patients across the country and across the world, and I help and I advocate, I help educate patients and their families, and I help coordinate with local facilities around the country and around the world because I have lots of affiliations in this particular niche market of hyperbaric oxygen therapy. So reach out to me, and I'm happy to talk to physicians as well. If anybody's interested in research, please, I'd love there to be more research in this field, and I'm happy to talk about, you know, what that would look like.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Samir. Have a great day.
Okay, you too. Thanks.